right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. Whew, quite a trip getting over here today, I'll tell you. You know, and for all those people that looked at me and they saw, or looked at this car and they saw a very angry face yelling and howling, I'm not apologizing because you got to learn how to drive, okay? Anyway, all right, so it's really driving you crazy getting out in this traffic here. All right, at the back end of the show, we are going to be talking with Pat Cavani, Cavane, author and performer of a play called Forgotten, a really fantastic play I saw a little while ago, and it's a one-man performance, and it's just really remarkable. I'll tell you a little bit more about that when we get to that segment. Before that, will be a very special beginning hint at what's coming. We're going to be playing an excerpt from a dialogue between Cornel West and Carl Dix, which took place recently at UC Berkeley. And the name of the dialogue was In the Age of Obama, Police Terror, Incarceration, No Jobs, Miseducation, What Future for Our Youth? And we're going to be playing the segment that was the actual exchange between Carl and Cornel. So stay tuned for that. But first up, I'm really happy to be joined in this segment by Dave Lindorf. He's a journalist. He's writes for the website, for among other places, for the website This Can't Be Happening. He's also the author of Killing Time, an investigation into the death row case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, which is one of the most thorough, it's the most thorough, actually, investigation of the frame-up of Mumia Abu-Jamal. And today marks the 30th anniversary. This is the 30th anniversary of the night that Mumia Abu-Jamal was framed, and it's just days after the Philadelphia DA decided not to try to have the death penalty reinstated against Mumia. And Dave's here to talk to us about the history of the frame-up and the significance of the latest developments and where to from here. Dave, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. Well, let's talk about this. Can you, just for people who might not be clear on what happened, what did happen in Mumia's case and what's the significance of it?
Well, there's pluses and minuses, but it's big any way you look at it. You know, his death penalty was overturned in 2001 by a federal judge. The DA promptly appealed that, and then in two rulings, panel of judges on the Third Circuit here in the Philadelphia area, that's the next layer above the federal district judges, upheld that overturning of his death penalty. And the DA first appealed it to the Supreme Court, which sent it back, trying to say that the judges had made a mistake and asking them to reconsider. And they slapped down the Supreme Court and said, no, we were right, and they upheld the overturning again. It went back to the Supreme Court, and on October 11th, the Supreme Court said they weren't going to reconsider it, and so the Third Circuit ruling stands. At that point, the district attorney had the right to seek a new trial with a new jury just on the penalty phase, not the conviction. And he announced in a historic decision that he would not, this is the current DA, he would not seek a new trial. That means that Abu-Jamal no longer faces a death penalty, period. He doesn't face execution. They can't keep him on death row anymore, and he'll have to go into the general prison population, but he also reverts to the alternative of life in prison without possibility of parole. So it's a pretty grim prospect for him because all his avenues of appeal of his conviction have already been rejected right up to the Supreme Court. So he has no real avenue of appeal anymore of any consequence, and he will be in the general prison population. He will be able to hold his grandchildren for the first time in his life. He will be able to have visitors who I believe he can even be filmed now, you know, with permission, which is never allowed in death row. So, you know, his life will improve on some level, but, you know, a very small level.
Right, right. In fact, actually, in some ways, you're locked in a coffin while you're still alive.
Yes. The downside, by the way, is that, you know, I had been thinking that, you know, it would be while it would be a risky move, that it would have been better for him had the DA decided to push for a new death sentence, because in an appeal, in a new hearing, rather, like that, because the argument for killing him was that, you know, the witnesses the prosecution presented were claiming that he had executed, you know, viciously executed Officer Faulkner by standing over him. The testimony was he stood over him and fired down at him four times, hitting him once between the eyes. That's pretty brutal execution description. I don't think it's correct. I think they were lying, and I could explain why, you know, during the hour or the half hour, whatever. But in any event, the defense would have had the absolute right to call those witnesses back, those who are still alive, and probe the veracity of their testimony in order to prove that, you know, to disprove the claim that he had executed brutally the officer. And in the course of doing that, they would have been able to impeach that testimony, I think, quite ably. And had they done so, that would have opened the avenue for a new trial. You see, the part of the problem is the defense for years has been, since 1995, has been unable to call witnesses under subpoena and compel them to testify under oath. So this would have given them the chance to do that. And there are a lot of witnesses who've come out since the trial that they simply can't bring forward. So this would have given him an avenue. And I think, frankly, that's why the DA really, you know, he's not admitting it, but I think that's why he made the decision to cut his losses and just lock him up for life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's what I was going to ask you, is actually why you thought he did it. Because I remember reading where you said exactly that point, that this could have opened up a whole pathway to challenging the actual conviction. And where that would have led is anybody's guess.
That's right. Of course, there was always a risk. I mean, the biggest risk would have been that in this highly corrupt legal system we have, and especially in Philadelphia and in Pennsylvania, and especially in this case where you have a black guy of leftist politics who's convicted of killing a white cop, you know, and with the Fraternal Order of Police, you know, heavily invested in killing him, they might have been able to get the court to change the venue out of Pennsylvania, out of Philadelphia, into some racist backwater in central Pennsylvania with an all-white jury, and have gotten the death penalty again, and that would have been bad news. So, you know, I don't think they could have done that, but it's always a risk that his defense attorneys had to bear in mind and that he had to bear in mind.
We're talking with David Lindorf, journalist, and he writes for ThisCan'tBeHappening.net, and he's also the author of Killing Time, an investigation into the death row case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, a really, really important book. And I'll tell you, Dave, I've read your book at least two or three times since I did that first interview with you around it when it came out, and it's really an exhaustive and really, really full investigation of it. And it leads me to my next question. What you're talking about in terms of what they would do, you know, the drive to actually nail Mumia that this system seems to be, you know, really running on, and even making every decision on how are they actually going to keep this thing hammered home, that, you know, and you talk about that in your book. You give a whole history of the frame-up, because a lot of people don't understand that it's not just a question of the irregularities in the so-called irregularities in the trial. It's also the question that there's a whole frame-up. We can talk about all the things that emerged in the trial, all the things that were wrong, unconstitutional, racist, all that in a minute. But I want people to get a sense of Mumia. There's a whole history to this frame-up that involves his, you know, being targeted by the police, all kinds of things that have gone on against him, right?
Well, let me back up a little bit, because I think I don't use the term frame-up in the book because until we're talking about after the shooting incident, and it was two shootings, by the way. It was the shooting of Mumia and a shooting of the cop. The two people got shot here. So it's really shootings on the night of December 9th. And the thing, my feeling, based on the evidence I was able to find and the evidence that was presented, I can't, as a journalist looking at it, make a claim that there was a frame-up preceding the shooting. In other words, I don't think that Mumia was set up in order to catch him and nab him before Faulkner was shot. I don't buy into anything that this was arranged in some fashion so that they could get him. I think that what happened was that, and there's certainly evidence to support this, that the minute the cops came on the scene and the detectives, particularly the detectives and the supervisors, got to the scene, maybe not the first three cops, but from the vicinity. But after that point, it was clear that they knew who was sitting down the sidewalk from, wounded from Faulkner with a gun beside him, and that was Mumia, and that they knew who he was. And I think from that moment on, the wheels started turning to make sure that he was the guilty party, whether or not he deserved to be, and that he was going to get first-degree murder, whether or not he deserved first-degree murder charges. And then, you know, then the frame-up continued in the form of, you know, I pretty clearly document that the key prosecution witnesses were lying with the knowledge of the prosecutor and the arrangement of the cops and the prosecution. So, yes, there was a frame-up, but I don't put the frame-up before the shooting.
Right. No, I think that's an important point. And I also think, though, that there is something to the fact that Mumia was not an unknown quantity to the Philadelphia Police Department. I mean,
absolutely, you know, not.
Yeah, and his history with the Panthers, his history with the MOVE organization, the conflict between the police and MOVE, what was in 78 when they had that big shootout. It was, you know, there's all these things that have gone on, and I think when they got him into court, I agree, I think that's actually where they really started the railroad running, you know, at full steam. And,
well, even before that, mm-hmm. I mean, I think the railroad started running from the moment they were picking up witnesses on the scene and, you know, trying to build a case.
Good point, yeah.
You know, I think from that moment on, you know, just let me give you an example. I was talking to a cop after looking at the crime scene photos, the official crime scene photos, which I finally got to see, you know, just recently for the first time. And that's an indication of the problems, you know, of this case. The defense was such a mess all these years that most of the files were in boxes uncatalogued, and the new attorneys that are handling this case, who are really crack attorneys, have spent the money to get all the evidence in order and, you know, where you can look at it. And, you know, when you look at these crime scene photos, one of the things that has come up is that there was a hat for the officer sitting originally at the time of the first police coming on the scene, sitting on top of the Volkswagen that belonged to Mumia's brother that started the whole incident because he was stopped by the cop. And the hat was on the passenger side of the car, and when you look at the picture, the window of the Volkswagen is down on the passenger side. Remember, this is in early morning hours, 3 o'clock in the morning, on a wintry, cold December 9th day, right? And the window's down. Now, if Billy Cook was the only person in that car, the officer would have gone to the driver's side, right?
Mm-hmm.
You never see a cop, you know, do a stop and then talk to you through the passenger side of the car,
right? Right.
And the window worked. So why was the window down, and why was the hat on the top of the car over the passenger side window? You know, there also was the fact that the cop was found to have had in his shirt pocket a license renewal request form for another party. This was Arnold Howard. And so he obviously had gotten that from somebody, right, and put it in his pocket. So the question is, I talked to a cop friend of mine, Philly cop, and I said, you know, what's the deal here? Why was the hat on the side of the car? And he said, this is a guy who is that age, you know, mm-hmm. what Faulkner would have been. He said, oh, you know, that's simple. He said, you know, back in the early 80s, we all had this big hair, you know, we cops, we had big hair, and Faulkner certainly did. And he said, you know, we were really proud of our hair. You know, we used a lot of Brill cream and stuff, and we were really proud of our hair. But the regulations in Philly were you had to have your hat on or you got cited by your superiors. So he said, what we do is we drive around in the car without our hats on because we didn't want to muss our hair. And then if we did if you saw a supervisor driving by, you'd quickly put your hat on your head. And if you had a stop, you'd go out and you'd bring your hat with you in case a supervisor came by. So he said, you know, if you did the stop, you'd put the hat up on the car where you could grab it really fast if a supervisor came on the scene, but otherwise you didn't wear it. So the hat was put on the car by Faulkner while he was talking to somebody, but it was on the passenger side, right?
Hmm. Yeah.
So that all that comes together, and you say, you know, if this had been at a trial, and if that cop could have been called in to talk, and if the Mumia's attorney had been smart enough, or Mumia had been knowledgeable enough to ask, you know, hey, what's that hat up there for, right? But also, the hat was moved. You know, we also know that there were pictures taken before the cops got on the scene that showed the hat on the car, and then the official photos showed the hat down on the grating down near where Faulkner was shot. So they moved the hat. They didn't want it up there on top of the car because that upset the scenario. Somebody knew, whoa, we don't want this here, only they forgot to close the window. So, you know, there's some pretty good evidence to suspect that there was another person in the car. Okay, so right away, the scenario that the prosecution presented, which was there were only two people who could have done this, Billy Cook or Mumia, and Billy, there's not any witness saying Billy did it, so Mumia did it. That falls apart if there's a possibility of another person in the car.
Well, let's look at this other thing, because, and we have just about 6 minutes left, but let's look at this other thing. You uncovered a couple of other pieces of evidence, and one you did your own. You and Lynn Washington, I guess, did this. You ran a gun test challenging one of the major tenets of the trial, of the accusations against Mumia. Can you tell people about that?
Yeah, this is fundamental to the case. If you, the prosecution claimed, and they had two, actually, pieces of it, and one good witness claiming to have seen Mumia stand astride the officer lying on his back on the sidewalk and shooting down at almost point-blank range at him, nailing him with one of the shots between the eyes and killing him. But none of the other shots hit him, right? There were no other bullet holes from the front into Officer Faulkner. So, you know, Lynn and I just immediately thought, well, where the hell are the bullet marks? You know, it's pretty hard to miss a body, but if you miss it, it's going to be right near the body on the concrete, right? He was lying on a sidewalk. So where are the bullet holes? Because there are photographs on the crime scene pictures of little circles drawn around fragments of bullets like 30 feet away and in the wall, you know, of a building, which could not have been from Jamal, because if he was shooting straight down, they never would have gone, you know, so far afield. So they were looking for bullets, they were circling bullets, but there are no circles around the body. So what we did is and not only that, there were no marks. We looked at the concrete, and we also had a scientist from Jet Propulsion Laboratory, Bob Nelson, who does the Cassini photos, you know, the enhancement of the Cassini photos from Saturn. He looked at the sidewalk and did his enhancement magic, and he said, there's no bullet holes here. So what we did is we took a hunk of old sidewalk to match the kind of sidewalk that was there, aged, dirty concrete, and we brought it out in the woods, and Lynn obtained a licensed pistol that was like Mumia's with a 2.5-inch snub-nosed barrel and 38 caliber, and we put the kind of bullets that the casings were found in his gun, high-velocity, copper-clad bullets, and we fired those at, you know, the same kind of stance into the concrete to see what they would do. And they chipped out craters out of the concrete, which were clearly visible because, you know, when they chip out the crater, it's fresh concrete underneath that's kind of bright white. And we filmed that and showed what they would look like on video, which people can see on our website. It's at the bottom of the homepage, Play the Movie. It's an eight-minute movie that'll blow people away. Clearly, the witnesses who said that happened were lying because there's no bullet holes. That's something that Mumia's attorney should have done, you know, at the trial, but they didn't. So now it can't be done. But, you know, anybody who's interested in justice would have to say, okay, so those guys are lying. And one of the key witness who lied was the one who said he saw the whole thing, and that was the white cab driver named Chobert, Robert Chobert, who, you know, could not have seen that. And so, you know, if they could call him back, they could question him about that. And I think his story would fall apart immediately.
Mm-hmm. And actually, somebody has pointed out in the film that they say that his cab was parked a certain spot. And actually, in the film, there's no cab there.
Oh, yeah. When you look at the police photos, there's no cab. There is no extant photograph anywhere, including the guy, the guy who was found to have gone there to take news pictures and got there before the police photographers did. He took the pictures while the cops were actually picking up the evidence and stuff. He has photos of them carrying the guns in their hands, you know, has photo of the hat on the car. You know, he got there first. His photos, too, don't show the taxi. Nobody shows the taxi parked behind Faulkner's car. And frankly, since this guy was driving on a suspended driver's license for 5 years for DWI and was also on probation for 5-year sentence for felony arson throwing a Molotov cocktail into a elementary school, he would not have parked his car behind a police car, believe me.
Right, yeah, exactly.
No, what person would do that? You know, so clearly he was not where he said he was, and his testimony was a complete fabrication.
Like much of the testimony in the trial. Dave, we're going to have to wrap this up, but I wanted to ask you one real quick question. You said that Mumia will be sent out into general population. He's in a supermax prison now. Is there any possibility that they would just simply keep him buried in the supermax prison?
They can't. He's
okay.
No longer a death row person. They mm-hmm. might try to keep him in solitary by claiming that there's a threat to his safety by mm-hmm. the general prison population, but that's bullshit. You know, it's just, I'm sorry, bull, do the beep there, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. But there's no, he's a hero among the prison population mm-hmm. for having, you know, stood up to this and for having defended prisoners everywhere. So, I mean, I think he's going to be the safest man in prison. But, you know, they may try to argue that he's under threat and keep him in solitary, but not on death row.
And as for my money, it's actually, you know, really, Mumia should not have been in prison. He certainly shouldn't be in prison now, but he never should have been there in the first place. Dave, I want to thank you very much for joining us today and for your work at thiscan'tbehappening.net, which is a really great, great journalistic website, and your work as the author of Killing Time, an investigation of the death row case Mumia Abu-Jamal. Still a book that anybody who wants to know anything about the Mumia case should pick this book up. Dave, thanks a lot, man.
Thank you for having me on.
Okay, take care now. All right, we're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we're going to be listening to a special section of excerpts from a dialogue between Carl Dix and Cornel West, so stay tuned. All right, welcome back. And that was Anti-Flag with Mumia's song. I figured that was a fitting interlude between the first section on Mumia Abu-Jamal and what's happening with his case and what we got coming up next. On December 2nd, up at UC Berkeley, there was a dialogue between Cornel West and Carl Dix, a dialogue between Cornel West, one of America's most provocative public intellectuals and a champion for racial justice since his childhood, and Carl Dix, a longtime revolutionary and a founding member of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And the title of this dialogue was, In the Age of Obama, Police Terror, Incarceration, No Jobs, Miseducation, What Future for Our Youth? A dialogue between Cornel West and Carl Dix. Over the next week or so, we're going to be playing, maybe 2 weeks, we'll be playing, you know, the main speeches, Carl's speech and Cornel's speech, but I also wanted to give you today a little taste of what that dialogue was like. And so we're going to run here a section of the dialogue that was an exchange between Cornel West and Carl Dix on a lot of different subjects. I'm sure you'll find this fascinating, invigorating, challenging, and provocative. So let's move into that exchange now.
See, now, every time we talk, you be outing me.
You keep telling
people that I'm motivated by love.
Oh, yes, absolutely. That's true. And Sister Lavette, your wonderful wife, would agree, though, brother. You got that deep love in you.
Most of the time, yes, she would. Mm-hmm. There's a few times. But I was thinking about a few things as you talked.
Yes, yes. Oh, my God.
There was the question of love, but I was also thinking about dreaming and revenge.
Yeah.
And see, on this dreaming piece, one thing that folks used to always say about me is, you just a dreamer. Mm. And I was kind of like, oh man, you know, what's wrong here? Am I not accomplishing things? Am I head in the clouds? But then I ran across a piece from Lenin, Vladimir Lenin, the leader of the Russian Revolution, where he talked about dreaming. And he basically said, ain't nothing wrong with dreaming as long as your dreams come from a basis of reality, and they are big dreams, but then you're constantly measuring the difference between your dreams and reality and working to narrow that distance.
Yeah, yeah.
By bringing reality in line with what you're dreaming, but also bringing your dreams back in line with reality, because if you dream in off somewhat, you might have to readjust those dreams because what you're thinking about can't be realized. And then once I came across that, I was like, hey, dreaming ain't so bad.
Dreaming ain't that bad. And a lot of it has to do with the content of the dream, because you can have fascist dreams.
Yes.
As opposed to deeply democratic ones, you know what I mean? Patriarchal dreams, homophobic dreams. But for me, this issue of love and hatred tied to a systemic analysis of power becomes crucial because, you know, George Bernard Shaw used to say, hatred is the coward's revenge against those who intimidate you. So hatred is always a species of cowardice, always, when it's geared to a person. But at the same time, if you hate injustice and you're willing to pay a cost the way Martin and the others did, then that has to do with love. And part of the problem these days is that we don't have enough people, especially for our young people, who embody that. You see, when I was coming along in the 60s, Huey Newton and Bobby Seale and Martin and Marion Wright Edelman and the others, it was very clear that they had such a depth of integrity that they would never sell out to the highest bidder, never. Whereas the market-driven society we have for our young people, you ask them who your heroes are, they tend to be those who are most visible in the market, who have the biggest money. You say, well, how much political courage do they have? Well, I hadn't really thought about that. And there's nothing wrong with having a certain kind of genius. You know, Sister Oprah Winfrey has entrepreneurial genius. I can celebrate her entrepreneurial genius, and I'll love her till the day I die. But when you juxtapose her with Ella Baker, you see that there's not a lot of political courage at work. And it has to do with her market calculations. Who's watching the show? Same is true for all these folk on television. You can just see them all cramped up. Don't really want to tell the truth because they have limits. That's the danger of putting all these folks, especially these days, it's almost rent a Negro on TV. You know what I mean? When you look up and you see all these black people talking, you say, wait a minute, you weren't talking that way 3 years ago. How come you're so tight and so narrow now? They got a job on the corporate media tab. I said, Lord have mercy. What happened? It's too truncated. We've got to provide examples to young people of free human beings of whatever color. And we need more of it. We need more of them.
Yeah, I'm glad when you said that hatred piece that you distinguished between hating injustice and hating people, because I think there is a real difference there. Because for me, the hatred of injustice is tied to the love for the people who are being unjustly treated.
Right.
And I actually like the way you out me, because that is where I'm coming from. And sometimes I don't always get around to it. But I think people need to get that. And then we need to grapple with this thing about revenge, because from one end, there are people who have been horribly abused in this society and in this world, and they should be angry about that. But then if all that takes you to is, I want to strike back, I want my chance, then you're not going to be able to fundamentally uproot all of that madness that I talked about and that Avakian talked about in that quote about what this society is like, the oppressive, exploitative relations and everything that goes along with it. So you got to hate the abuse that's coming down, but you also have to hate it enough and love the people enough for being abused to want to get scientific about it.
Mm-hmm.
Where is this coming from? How can we understand that? And how can we move to deal with it? Who are the allies that we can bring forward in this struggle? So I think that's important. And that's one of the things, because sometimes when people hear me say, it's not our youth's fault, they didn't create this situation, they think I'm giving them a pass and that they can stay into the shit that they're into. That's not it at all.
That's right.
I'm understanding the situation that they're faced with and what they're in. But then the other thing I got to say with them is, now that we know why you're facing this situation, we got to say, what are we going to do about it?
That's right.
Are you going to go
that's
out right. the way that they've put up there for you to go out? Or are we going to stand up? Are we going to say, no, we ain't going out like that?
That's right.
We are
that's
not less than human, and we will not be dehumanized and become inhuman. In fact, we are going to bring forward, we're going to be emancipators of humanity. We're not just looking to get the shit off of us and everybody else. We're looking to overturn the structures that have weighed down heaviest on us, but also are weighing down on people all around the world. Quite heavily too, you know, so.
That's right.
That's
one of the things that I like about Brother Avakian's distinction between envy and resentment on the one hand and righteous indignation on the other is that it resonates with my own legacy of Jerusalem as filtered through slavery, Jim Crow, and the black musical tradition. Because what happens oftentimes is if you engage in righteous indignation, in this society, people want to reduce that down to you having just envy and resentment. In the same way that when different groups come together, like let's say you people like the black community, all the black community has is interest. That's not true. That's the way the dominant corporate media puts it forward. But there's principles as well as interest. And never allow anybody, any group, to reduce you as an individual just for your interest. It may not be in your interest to save your child, but you're going to try to do it anyway because you got principles. It may not be in your interest to save your mama, somebody trying to violate her, but you love her, so you're going to do something because you have principles. But what has happened in the last 40 years, anytime you talk about black folk, it's just a matter of a special interest group. Martin Luther King Jr. didn't lead a special interest group. He led a group of de-niggerized black people. That's very important. Because to be niggerized is what? To be so scared and afraid and intimidated, you want to do nothing. To be de-niggerized is stand up. We willing to live. We willing to die. Martin said, my kind of folk. Now, what else did he say to him? Better put on your cemetery clothes. That's what he used to say all the time. Because down in gut bucket, American apartheid, you could get killed quick. But it was based on principle. It wasn't just black interests. And we need to get back to talking about principles and ideals as well as just interests. So white brothers and sisters, is it in my interest to help poor people? Well, what kind of human being do you want to be? If it's just a matter of your individual interests, you can join a crypto-fascist movement. Oligarchs can be freedom fighters if they so choose. They just have to commit a certain kind of class suicide, you know. But as individuals, they can choose based on their principles. We need to get back to talking. That's what I love about the Occupy movement again, you see. Not the envy and resentment, but the principles. And you see that throughout the work of my dear brother Ovakian. On that point, we in deep solidarity. I know I got disagreements on another. Now, do you want to say something about the God question?
Well, I was going to say, there's two places I was thinking about taking it.
Yes.
And one was coming off of, because you keep doing things like, you know, it resonates, Ovakian's distinction between indignation
and envy and resentment.
Resentment resonates with where you're coming from, and you did it up there earlier. And I could come from another way on that.
Okay.
Because when the thing that Marx does about socialism and communism, socialism being from each according to their ability, to each according to their work, and communism being from each according to their ability, to each according to their need, is actually drawn from some biblical
sources. Oh, sounds like the book of Acts. Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right.
So, you know, there's a way in which,
that's right.
And what he was getting at there was, you know, you can draw knowledge from a lot of different places.
Absolutely.
But he was getting at the kind of world that could be brought into being. And then, you know, when we talked the last time, I think I got into the point, and a lot of people focus up communism and Marxism on the thing about the opiate of the people. But I remember I read Marx for the first time for a college writing course. And I read him because the teacher says, all right, you got to do an essay, and here are the different authors you could take to write the essay on. But I must tell you, if anybody takes Karl Marx, I will fail them.
Ooh, really?
Okay, now, this teacher, she didn't know me very well, because I was like, I got to take Karl Marx, you know? And I read him, and I was like, this stuff makes some sense. And one of the things I remembered reading was his point about religion being the heart of a heartless world. And at that point, I had earlier been raised up in the church, and folks were like, oh, this going to be the new head of the church. This going to be like the pastor, because at the age of 10, I would do all the church plays and, you know, the nativity things, and I'd know all the roles, and people would forget their lines, and I would whisper it to them. So they're like, he's going to go far with this.
He knows the Bible and all this kind of stuff. A preacher and a pastor.
But then I was up against questions that I could not deal with in the context of religion. And then I read Marx's thing, you know, and I dropped out of the church, but I didn't go to atheism. I was just like, I don't know about it. But then I read his thing about the heart of a heartless world, and that what needs to be done is we need to put heart in the world by getting rid of capitalism and all that it means. And in a world with heart, what would be the role of religion? You know, and that's a Marxist approach to that.
Yeah.
Now, I know you got a take on that, because I'm sure you've run into this before, so I just wanted to put that out there in terms of we are actually working to put heart in the world by ending the heartlessness of the oppression, the vicious exploitation of capitalism, imperialism. And then through the course of that, people will still be able to practice religion in a revolutionary society.
Sure.
It would be a wrong approach to try to suppress that. But that heart in a heartless world would no longer be necessitated.
Yeah.
And that's part of where we see.
No, but I see the power of that. I see the power of that claim, though. I mean, there's no doubt that the history of religious institutions have been excessively accommodating to structures of domination, be it imperialism, white supremacy, male supremacy, anti-Semitism, anti-Arab race, and so forth. But when we're talking about religion as I understand it, and Christian faith as I understand it, you're actually talking about those prophetic voices and conversational partners that go alongside the margins of all of these different religious institutions. Most of Christianity is Constantinian Christianity, which is so accommodated to the prejudices of the world, owing to a cowardice, that people use it as a coping mechanism rather than a source of generating courage. Most of Judaism is constitutional Judaism. Jews in America, moving into the upper middle class, falling in love with the felicities of bourgeois existence, falling in love with respectability from the goyim, never thinking that you actually could be mainstream given the vicious history of anti-Semitism. No, Amos says, have a critical suspicion of that. It's right there in the text. Jonah says, every Yom Kippur, read, have a suspicion of that. That's very difficult. Most forms of Buddhism in America, Constantinian Buddhism, accommodated to prejudice. But the prophetic is suspicious. And that's true actually in terms of secular institutions. Liberalism's accommodation to vicious forms of imperialism, for example. And we know, you know, the failures of Marxism in terms of the gangster-like communist regimes of Stalin and a whole host of others, killing millions and millions and millions of people. But there's a prophetic element in the Marxist analysis that says the precious humanity of poor and working people must be accented even in the face of the gangster-like communist regime. Marxist critique of communist regimes in that sense. And you would accept that, though.
Well, I'd want to talk about this gangster-like regime's point. No, because...
Yeah. I mean, because Stalin was a gangster. You agree with that?
No, I don't agree that he was a gangster. He led the first socialist revolution after the death of Lenin, and he was trying to do something that had never been done before, and there were shortcomings in the understanding of the communist movement at that point. No, and he had to move with this. He had to say, all right, we've socialized the means of production, but there's a lot of disagreements here. Where are they coming from? And at that point, the communist movement had no understanding of where you would get that kind of resistance socialized. And
but Stalin,
flowing
but he
from
went to
that,
seminary. He knew it's not right to wipe out your friends.
Okay.
I mean, you get that in seminary. You know, you don't need
well,
a whole
I'm
lot
not
of
sure
Marxist
what he
analysis.
Got in, I'm not
that.
Sure what he got in seminary.
Well, he might have got the wrong thing in seminary,
that might be,
depending on which one he went
to. That's another question.
Yeah, you're right about that, though. That's
no,
true.
But it was
that's
like...
Point. No, that's a good point. But wiping out your friends is wrong.
He was dealing with contradictions...
Killing peasants is wrong. You know?
...under socialism that he didn't know where they were coming from. Now, Mao was able to look at what they did in the Soviet Union and say, okay, this is where those contradictions were coming from. It's not enough just to make the farm collective property. It's not enough to make the factory collective property. You actually have to deal with relations between people left over from the old society, those who work with their minds, those who work with their backs. You have to deal with the fact that you got to have exchange between the farms and the factories. And those are differences that can contain the seed of antagonism if you don't handle them right. And Mao was able to work at that much better. And then Avakian has gone even beyond that. But see, part of what we have done in going at this is actually look at what were those societies trying to do. How did they go about it? And what did they achieve? Because in both Russia and China, you were talking about societies where the people were poor, illiterate, beaten down.
No doubt.
And in both of those societies, people's material conditions were transformed. Literacy was brought to them. In China, they went even farther. They started out with 70 million drug addicts. They wiped out drug addiction as a social problem, and not by punishing the people who were on drugs, but by giving them a source of hope in the new societies that they forged, and by treating addiction as a medical problem. So those are things that you can learn from that. Mm-hmm. And on the basis of learning that, Avakian also looked at, and here's where they went wrong. Stalin on not being able to get the difference between contradictions between the enemy and contradictions among the people. Mao, by getting that, but still going up against things like thinking that there should be an official ideology for the society. No, there shouldn't be an official ideology. There should be contention between a lot of different viewpoints. That's what Avakian has brought forward in terms of solid core with a lot of elasticity, that we need a setup where there's diversity, debate, discussion, and dissent, including from the people who say socialism is
precious liberties.
We need to hear from them because they will know some things and understand some things that the people who are with you don't get. And if you don't hear from them, that's going to mean you don't know enough about reality to transform it in the desired direction.
Another authoritarian regime, though. No, but see, this is another reason why, though, you and I resonate so much in terms of the critique of not just unfettered markets, but of capitalist relations in which there's asymmetric relations of power at the workplace, bosses and workers. Mm-hmm. In terms of the alternative, it's a larger discussion. I know we want to open it up. But once we get to talk about Stalin and Mao and so forth, we part company.
Okay.
we do part company on that, though, brother.
That's part of why we have a dialogue.
That's exactly. Because I think we have to be very clear in our language, you know, no matter what the historical conditions are, no matter what the difficulties are, it's just wrong to kill folk. You know what I mean? That's an arbitrary use of power. And we see arbitrary use of power in feudal societies. We see it in capitalist societies. A lot of people in America don't like to see it. Brother Grant shot down. That's arbitrary police power. Brother Anthony Troy is executed by the state.
Troy's execution.
That's arbitrary power.
What Mumia Abu-Jamal is facing.
And Brother Mumia, of course, we're going to be highlighting.
We're going to be in Philadelphia.
30 years. We're going to be in Philly together.
Yeah. Yeah.
But Brother Mumia, free man on black on death row. But still, there's arbitrary powers at the top. Anytime you have centralized power that's unaccountable. I don't care if it's in the public sector, the private sector, civil society, and so on. And that's where our discussion, if we had a whole lot of time, we'd wrestle with. But you think we should open it up for?
Well, we should open it up. Yeah, I would just say that the thing about solid core with elasticity is exactly to see, because we understand there's a contradiction between the leadership and the land, even in a revolutionary society. And part of how you deal with that is unleashing that diversity, that debate, and that dissent, so that the leadership is not unchecked. That's also why we want to publish a constitution for the future socialist republic now, so people can say, this is what they say they're going to do. Let's see how they build up to it, and then let's see how they act.
And that's the right to dissent.
Yeah.
The right to express dissent, right to cut against the grain, the right to frankly speak. No, absolutely.
That's all in that constitution, and we want people to know that, so they can say if it ain't going down. And then another thing's in there is not doing the death penalty.
Oh, well, we know how barbaric that is now. The death penalty, the nation state having the capacity to take a human life?
No,
there might be an element of doubt?
Yeah.
That's barbaric. At least for me, that's just barbaric. There's just no doubt about that. You're right about that.
All right, that was Carl Dix and Cornel West, the diet and exchange between the two of them. We're going to run more from that dialogue next week. But right now, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking with Pat Kinavan about his new play, his play Forgotten, really an astounding, stunning play. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
When I get older, losing my hair, many years from now, will he still be sending me a Valentine? Birthday greetings, bottle of wine. If I'd been out till 2:45, would you lock the door? Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
All right. When I'm 64, and for those of you who are 64, you know the song anyway. It's from the Beatles. For those of you who aren't, learn it, kids, learn it, okay? All right, I'm really pleased to welcome my next guest to the show. Last Saturday, I saw a play that stayed with me the entire week, and I kept coming back to it, thinking different things about it and trying to, you know, it just sat on my brain. That's basically what it was, and the play was Forgotten. Very compelling play. And joining us to talk about all this is Pat Kinnevane, who's the author and the actor in this one-person solo play. Pat, welcome to the show.
Michael, thank you so much. It's lovely to be here.
Well, you know, why don't we tell people what the play is about?
Well, Forgotten is it's a piece, really, that I put together about essentially 10 years ago, and then I reworked it. But it's about how people age in Ireland in particular, and whether they're in a rest home or in a hospital or whatever. It's more to do with attitudes to ageing, how people feel when they come toward the end of their lives, and ultimately what sort of respect and dignity that we're left with at the end of our lives, particularly in a Western society. I tried to approach it really with as much love as I could, but also there is, Michael, and you'll understand, you're an Irish man as well underneath it. I had a bit of fury, you know, I was a little bit angry about it. So I had to write about it because I'm still kind of upset at the fact that for all the money we had in Ireland in particular over the last few years, and we lost it all, but we never really invested in, you know, facilities and future care for each other. And as we come to that vulnerable time in our lives. So that's really what the impetus was behind it.
How did you create the stories? Because you have, for people who don't know, you have four characters, two women and two men, and they're from some of them are interconnected in their lives, and they may be in different nursing homes or whatever, but there's some interconnection between them. And I think one, I couldn't figure out whether he was connected or not, but there's stories there that vary so wildly in terms of the aspects of life that you bring out from people. And in a way, it's like some concentrate on one aspect, others concentrate, like I'm thinking, and I can't remember the character's name, but the one that had the mask on the back of...
Yes, Gustus. Yeah.
Gustus, yeah. Who's very, very despairing.
Yes,
it seems. And then you have Eukarya.
Eukarya, yeah.
Who's like, you know, in a whole other world. Almost, I mean, it's very interesting. You know, and you could tell people about these characters. But how did you actually fashion that? Was this based on stories that you had heard from people or talking with people? And how did you come up with these different elements in each of the characters? It's almost like four different elements going on at the same time.
Yeah, I had worked myself in a care facility, and I did a lot of research through a really beautiful sister of mine who's been working with older people for 25, 30 years now. And what I tried to do was create four fictional characters. They're all aged between 80 and 100. But I really wanted to represent them in a way that old people have never been represented before. I wanted to represent them in a graceful way. I wanted to represent them in that they have a sense of humour. I also wanted to represent, as you said, the bleak aspect of it. It's that kind of fear that must be there. And we all have it at some times of our lives, but when you're particularly vulnerable, the fear of just expiration and are you going to be by yourself or are you going to be surrounded by your family? All those things I wanted to address, but most particularly I wanted to kind of address how idiosyncratic and how strange we all are. It doesn't matter what age we are, you know. I think I have my own private theory anyway about, you know, people in my family and other people's elderly relatives, that if you are a bit nasty when you're younger, you probably are going to be nastier when you get older. And if you're beautiful and you're really nice and full of love, that you actually maybe are going to be like that when you're on the way out as well.
But you know what comes out in the play as well, though, is that no matter what you were in your life, that, I mean, there's a certain sense that you get in that play of people end up in very, you know, their humanity comes through in a situation where most of them are in very, you know, they're not in pleasant situations. They're not, they're in these places where, at least the way they're presented, they're isolated, alone. And in a way, the story that you've chosen to come out of them is sort of like, it's almost like you imagine someone who's verging on leaving the mortal coil, but mm-hmm. is also opening their mouth, and the story, the significant aspects of their life were come pouring out. And it's to me, it was very, there was, each of them had that element of despair as well as celebration in it. You know, each of them did. And it was something that was really struck me because, you know, it's a very different way to approach things.
I suppose, yeah, the whole idea of the word forgotten, I was interested in, because I went to see an old aunt of mine. She was a beautiful woman, and she was in a beautiful nursing home, and it was so well kept, and they were so well looked after. This is years ago I saw this, and it was like, you know, it was a kind of a slap across the head to me, really, because I looked down and I saw all the beds, Michael, one bed after the other, rows and rows of elderly women, all beautifully dressed. But I thought some of them have visitors and some of them did not. And the ones that didn't, I thought, I just wonder now, are they forgotten about? Do they have sons or daughters or nieces and nephews that call maybe once a week or maybe once every 6 months? Do you know what I mean? And it's that thing really of the world. It doesn't matter whether it is Ireland or Spain or America. That thing of rush, 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 go, 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 accumulate. And we forget about the important thing, the really important treasures that are there, as in the wisdom of older people, to be able to sit down and listen to them. We don't have time half the time. I'm to blame. Everyone's to blame. But it's that thing of returning really to that sort of three-dimensional family where there was always an older person in the house to go to. So if the parents were out, for example, the children might be able to go and get wisdom from their grandparents. And so the older person, the kind of elder statesman in the family, had respect because of that. And they were useful because of that. But I think that's kind of diminished. And sorry, I'm babbling.
No, that's fine. Actually, and I was just thinking, look, you think about it. In this society, old people are pretty much human garbage in the way that they're treated. In all these capitalist societies, that's what people come down to. It's human garbage. When you no longer can be worked to death, they just toss you to the side. And
absolutely.
And I one of the things I got from your characters, which was very, very heavy, was that again, that pouring out of the significant aspects of their lives to leave a mark in the universe. You know, in a way, it was very like molecules coming out and they're going to station themselves in the universe, be part of the universal flow. And that was, to me, really, really moving. You know,
I take all sorts of kind of influences from all over the place. It could be anything. I'm not kind of timist like that. And at the moment, there's even after writing Forgotten, it's that thing about leaving a mark. You know, maybe it's a passion in us all. I don't know. I'm just speaking off the top of my head that maybe it's just that when we're coming to the end of our lives like that you want just to let somebody know, just somebody, what you've done in your life. Even if it's a stranger, even if you're just holding somebody's hand and saying, do you realise that I went here and I did this? And actually, Beyoncé Knowles has a beautiful song on her new album, 4, and it's called I Am Here. And it's about that. It's just that thing of, you know, I did my best. I have a story to tell. And maybe it's human nature just to divulge that story before we go. And that's, I suppose, why I tried to do it through the theatre, was to give these people who possibly wouldn't have had a voice some sort of leverage and some sort of freedom. Mm-hmm. You know?
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I'm talking today with Pat Kinavane. He's the author and playwright. He's the playwright and the performer in the play Forgotten. One of the things, Pat, I wanted to ask you about, because what we're not talking about is there's an added element here that is very, very different than most. Most people, and there's a joke about anybody who's got any Irish background can tell stories forever. So it's one thing to write the stories, to tell the stories, to act the stories out, but you bring a whole different element into it, kabuki. What the hell were you thinking, man?
After having 4 bottles of wine, and I was very upset. No, I suppose I've always been interested in Asian theatre, and purely my only, and I call it my humble interest in it, was because it's aesthetic, and to look at it, it's pleasing. And it, to me, it didn't have to have a meaning, or it didn't have to have some sort of huge, you know, Beckettian sort of depth, even though there's nothing wrong with Beckett. But you know what I mean? I like the fact that sometimes you can be just transported visually by something. Also, that's why I use this style, or I was influenced by kabuki theatre. So what I'm doing is not kabuki. It's actually just a different sort of mishmash and kind of melting pot of different styles of Asian theatre put in together, but primarily kabuki, because the spectacle of it really interested me. And I suppose I wanted to keep the audience visually stimulated during the piece. Also, I am fascinated by the Eastern philosophies and Eastern societies' outlook on the elderly. There's a sense of, particularly in Japan, maybe it's diminishing, I don't know, but that sense of duty that sometimes we forget in the West, that duty sometimes it's an important burden to carry, because it means that those who need us most know they're going to be looked after, because they know the younger people have a duty. So I'm interested in that, whole philosophy of obligation. Mm-hmm. And then the third thing really for me was that I wanted to represent older people on stage in a new way. I wanted to represent them without walking frames, without, you know, hip replacements, without all those things, which are a reality, but I didn't want to do the stereotypical sort of representation. I wanted to take people on a journey where when you look at some, when you look at a senior citizen, maybe, just maybe, they move beautifully. Mm-hmm. Maybe we misinterpret the movement, but maybe that's a very beautiful thing to watch somebody walk with an imperfection rather than, you know, and no offence to the girl, but rather than Christy Turlington walking down a ramp, you know what mm-hmm. I mean? Mm-hmm. It's that, again, it's the changing of the mind of that everything is beautiful no matter what. Mm-hmm. What it's an expression of humanity, and no matter what way we all move, it's kind of miraculous. Mm-hmm. So that's what I was trying to do. Boy, I can't believe I just said that.
It was good, man. It was very good. And the play is excellent. The play is
Thank
really
you so
excellent.
Much, man.
Sure, sure. And you've been doing it for 6 years now, huh?
Mm.
Yeah, so it's remarkable. And I'm sure you get something more out of it every time you perform it. And I want to thank you very much for joining
thank
us
you
today.
Thank you so sure. much for having us on here. Sure, it's just
sure.
a pleasure.
Sure. All right, the play is Forgotten, and the playwright is Pat Kinnavan. And we've spent the last segment of the show talking with Pat about his play and about the treatment, the just savage treatment of old people in this society, the way that people are cast to the side and left to die, left to go out with no one caring. This is what it's like to get old in this dog-eat-dog society. And Pat raises a voice in opposition to that. And it's something we should all be thinking about all the time, all right? And it brings me to something I used to say all the time that I need to be saying a whole lot more. And that is that the world cries out for revolutionary change. Like never before, it cries out for this kind of change. And it's possible to get there. There's absolutely no reason why we continue to live the way that we live in this society. The only reason that we have to live like this is because of the capitalist imperialist system. We haven't always lived like this, and we don't need to keep on living like this. We can do something about it. We can get rid of this system, but we got to come together to do that. On that note, I want to thank all of my guests for joining us today. Dave Lindorf, who writes for the ThisCan'tBeHappening.net website and is the author of Killing Time, the most extensive and thorough investigation and exposure of the legal frame-up of Mumia Abu-Jamal. I also want to thank the people who sponsored the Carl Dix Cornell West dialogue up in UC Berkeley for letting us use the sound from that dialogue, and we'll be playing a lot more of that in the weeks to come. And I want to thank my last guest, Pat Kinnavan, for joining us in studio to talk about his very moving, very provocative, and very unique play. You've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm the host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank my board op for today, Teddy Robinson, my production assistant, Henry Carson, and all of you for tuning in. And if you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with a song that I think is particularly relevant for the show, for the ethos and the spirit of the show that we put on today. And that song is Stand from Sly Stone.
Set out to do. Stand.
There's a cross for you to bear.
Things to go through if you're going anywhere.
There's a midget standing tall,
and the giant beside him about to fall.